I'll tell you again, referencing my Honda biography. According to Honda's son, he had never seen his father, quote, as pissed off as he was when the Shiae made it into this film.
When the Shiae hit the fan, you could say. That was a terrible pun. Sorry.
I feel like you had been saving that one. You delivered it so, like, oh, this is my moment.
I didn't think about it until like 10 seconds ago, but the opportunity arose, you know? I couldn't say no. Hello, and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Podcast. We're your hosts, Matt Levine.
And Vincent Hannum.
And we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time.
Traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between, all strange beasts are welcome here.
Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes.
Now, Giant Entertainment. Giant Terror. Monster Zero.
Do you see anything?
From a planet 50 million miles beyond the stars came a strange message. Lend us your Rodan and Godzilla to fight our Monster Zero. Earth answered. And the most dreaded creatures ever to walk our planet are lifted into outer space. The stage is set for the mightiest battle ever seen by the universe in Monster Zero.
All forces on Earth ready to attack.
What started out as a call for help from space turns into a nightmare of terror on Earth, Monster Zero.
And Vincent, it's good to see you again. How you doing?
So good. I have been thinking a lot about the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Since we recorded 2 weeks ago, it's just such a fun movie.
It is. I've been thinking about it a lot too. I think I gave it our highest rating when we recorded last time. And if anything, my opinion about it has only increased since then. It's so good.
Same. I gave it the second to highest for the record, everybody. But I'm slow. If I were to rate this again, it might be a top tier.
And I might have to invent a new tier, the fifth out of our four tiers for the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. I'm just kidding. It maybe is not that much of a masterpiece, but it is really great. I loved it a lot.
Yeah.
The movie that we're talking about tonight, Invasion of Astro Monster, is, well, I don't want to ruin anything. We'll see. You know, it's to be determined if that's at the same level as Beast from 20,000 Fathoms or not.
All right.
You know, as we talk about like recent things that have happened in the world of cinema, I feel like first of all, we have to say rest in peace to one of the best of all time, David Lynch.
Yeah. And this is another regrettable blind spot in my, movie watching history. I'm almost ashamed to say it. I have never seen a David Lynch film.
Whoa.
I don't even know where to start.
Yeah, I mean, that's surprising. If only, I mean, you love monster and horror movies so much, and his movies aren't maybe like directly horror, but they do have some sort of like quasi monsters in them, and they're very scary at times. So I feel like you would love them. And he's a great filmmaker, not without his flaws, certainly, but you know, I feel like the best place to start is his first feature, Eraserhead, which is still my favorite. And definitely has a monster in it. So there's like the whole monster movie connection there. But I mean, Mulholland Drive, Inland Empire, The Straight Story, Lost Highway, so many great movies.
Yeah. I mean, I hear about them all the time. Always have. Definitely on my watch list for sure.
Awesome. Yeah. So, you know, rest in peace to one of the best creators of movie nightmares of all time.
Yeah. Love that.
Not to mention Twin Peaks, which I'm rewatching the third season, The Return, right now, which is terrifying.
Now, was that a movie first or a TV show first?
It was a TV show first. So they did the first two seasons in 1990 and 91.
Okay.
And then they had a movie spinoff, Fire Walk With Me, which I think was from 1992. And then the third season was a little bit belated. That was from 2016 or 17. So that one's a little bit more recent.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can't live in the pop culture sphere without hearing Twin Peaks. So again, this is all been on my radar. So I got to do my due diligence here.
Well, you have a lot of great, if kind of unsettling, movie experiences in front of you.
Can't wait. Based on the tributes I've seen on my Instagram, disembodied ears, lots of weird surrealist things. So I can't wait.
Totally. Yeah. I'm excited to hear what you think about them for sure. What about you? Have you seen any good monster movies recently?
Not a monster movie per se, but it deals with angels. Have you seen Wings of Desire?
Mm-hmm.
German film from the late 80s?
Yeah, great movie.
Yeah, like art house cinema, but but I think still accessible to just your average moviegoer. Peter Falk plays a really great character, and I watched it with Ellen, and we enjoyed it. It was very artsy, you know, so we didn't quite get all of it, but I came away really enjoying that one too.
Yeah, I like that movie a lot. I think it's very beautiful. A lot of it is in black and white. The last like half an hour maybe is in color. Really love that director, Wim Wenders, who also made Paris, Texas, Alice in the Cities, Pina. He made Perfect Days, which just came out last year. So he's a great filmmaker, and Wings of Desire is one of his best, I would say.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Cool. I was worried you were going to say that you rewatched God Told Me To when you brought up Angels. I was like, why? Don't do it. I'm mostly kidding. I hate that movie a little bit more than I probably should. I mean, I was maybe a little harsh on it, but
I don't need to revisit it. I'm just going to say that.
Not anytime soon, anyway. Yeah. Nice. Well, Wings of Desire is great. I wanted to bring up a movie from last year, which is kind of a monster movie that I really liked, The First Omen, which I wasn't sure if I was going to like it. It's a prequel, of course, to the Omen series, and it's really well made. It has some really scary moments, some things I didn't like about it, but if you're a fan of the Omen series or just kind of devil horror movies in general, it's very, very good.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen the first one. I enjoyed it. I found it unsettling. I am not opposed to diving into that series a little bit more. So that's good to know.
Yeah. In a way, Satan is like the biggest monster of them all. So I feel like Camp Kaiju adjacent.
We don't get into too many demons yet on this show. Like, we could do The Exorcist. We could do The Omen. I mean, possession movies are there for the viewing. And maybe one day we'll get to them.
Yeah, I kind of hope so. It's a very compelling and I think usually pretty frightening theme, in my opinion.
Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, that, maybe.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I get excited about Rosemary's Baby. Won't say anything about Roman Polanski, but Rosemary's Baby maybe is my favorite horror movie of all time.
It's like a perfect film.
Yeah.
If I may use that term. It's just so tightly constructed.
Totally agree. It's fascinating. It's perfectly made. Mia Farrow's fantastic. John Cassavetes is too. A masterpiece. I love that movie.
Yeah, truly. Yeah.
So many great horror and monster movies to talk about. But before we dive into tonight's episode, we'll just talk about a few Camp Kaiju nuts and bolts here. Thanks again for hanging out, all of you listening to this episode. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com or our Instagram page at camp_kaiju. If you would like to be a featured voice on the show, leave a voicemail at 612-470-2612, telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories. If you've seen Invasion of Astro Monster and want to tell us your thoughts about this movie in particular, please do so. We would love to hear them. Finally, please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more reviews and special content. You can find merch at campkaiju.threadless.com And you can become a patron at patreon.com/campkaiju. You'll get discounts, priority comments, and access to any live events, which we might have a couple coming up over the next few months. So, yeah, check it out if you're interested in becoming a patron.
Well, we do have one, and that's our trivia night coming up in May. We're going to be partnering with Naomi Osborne. Shout out, friend of the pod there. She hosts a movie trivia each month on the first Monday of that month. So the first Monday in May, Matt and I will be with Naomi at Indeed Brewing in Minneapolis. And if you are a patron and you wish to join us and play along at the trivia night, you'll get one drink on us, alcoholic or not. Just we would love to see you and talk some movies, nerd out, and play some trivia. Of course, if you're interested in that, local Twin Cities listeners, and you want to become a patron, there's some incentive for you. If you don't want to become a patron, that's okay. Still come to trivia. We'd love to see you. I also have, Matt, this is new to you. I'm just spitballing here, but
I'm excited.
I have a little game/contest I want to run by you for later in this episode related to Nick Adams.
Ooh.
And I would like to offer listeners the chance to win an exclusive Nick Adams fan club t-shirt that I'm going to make. Now, more to come, so stick around to the end of the episode.
Amazing. I wish I could get my hands on that Nick Adams shirt, but you know, it's some lucky patron or you know, participant out there is going to take advantage of that. Sounds
100%.
Awesome.
Patrons, you're in. Just let me know and I will get you your Nick Adams official t-shirt.
He's one of a kind. I mean, not only that, you know, identifiably New York face in like the middle of a Godzilla movie, which we'll talk about soon, but just that Brooklyn accent, like everything about him is so amusing to me. I love it.
And he's so dedicated. I have a lot to say about Nick Adams, but I won't get ahead of myself.
Well, we'll definitely get to him soon because he's heavily featured in Invasion of Astro Monster. I also wanted to throw out a call for writers. If you love writing about movies, you know, monster movies in particular, but really movies in general, we would love to perhaps feature your writing on our website. We're looking for more reviewers. Vincent, is there anything else you want to say about this position?
Oh, just reach out to us. campkaiju@gmail.com is the best place to do that. Let's just chat. Let's see if you're interested. And yeah, we'll see what's possible. But we'd love to get more voices on the show, on the website. So that's where we're coming from.
Totally. I love that. Really excited to see who reaches out to us.
Yeah.
I see that you also have a shout out to our Norwegian listeners. Did you have anything in particular there?
Yeah, so big shout out. Hey, sorry, Sweden. I guess you're not our top listenership anymore in representing the Nordic countries, but I recently switched our podcast hosting network website, and this site gives us a breakdown on by country on our listeners. And Oslo, Norway, we have dozens of downloads a week coming out of Oslo.
Whoa.
So
cool. I love to hear that. I want to do like a frantic search for Norwegian monster movies right now because I have to admit I don't know a lot of them, but they might have to be featured soon.
Well, for all you listening out there, Skull, also Troll Hunter's on our radar. If there's others, please let us know. But got Troll Hunter from Denmark. We have Reptilicus from Sweden. I know we have. Maybe let the right one in.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. For sure.
So, yeah, you know, we love to shout out our Scandinavian brethren.
Yeah, we might have to do like a Scandinavian theme week or a theme month sometime soon. We'll see if that happens. But thank you to our listeners in Norway and, you know, wherever you are. Thank you to all of our listeners. We really appreciate it. Scandinavian or not. And again, a special thank you to our patrons. I just want to shout out Jason, Chris, Sean, Peggy, and our anonymous patron. Thank you so much. Let's see. What has happened in the world of monster movies since we last recorded? Wolfman came out. Have you seen it yet? The remake
no.
of Wolfman?
Did you?
No, not yet.
It got pretty bad reviews.
It did. I saw that. I'm still excited. You know, the Invisible Man remake, also by Lee Wanell, I thought was decent. There were some things I didn't like about it, but kind of an interesting update for the modern age. So I do want to see Wolfman, but maybe not expecting too much.
And let's be honest, we're not here to judge a movie critically. We're going to just enjoy it one way or the other because it's a werewolf movie. It's a universal werewolf movie. Yeah, why not? Let's watch it.
Indeed. And we just talked about the original Wolfman a couple months ago, which is a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
Oscar nominations came out. Not surprisingly, not too many monster movies in there, although The Substance is definitely a monster movie and is absolutely worth seeing. It's a lot of fun and also has a very pointed thematic commentary about Hollywood and gender representation and so on.
Yeah. And I see Nosferatu got a few nominations in production design, makeup and hairstyling, costuming, which I think is totally warranted.
Yeah.
That was my favorite part of the movie. Just like the enriched world Eggers brought us into.
Yep. For sure. Wicked got some nominations as well, which is maybe like monster movie adjacent a little bit. But yeah, I mean, as always, I love to hate the Oscars. I will definitely watch them in like a month and a half or whenever they are, late February, I think. So yeah, that's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what came out around this time in monster movie history, speaking of, you know, early mid-February, around that time frame, I think we talked about a couple of these during our last episode. Is there anything else that you want to shout out in the movies that I have listed here?
Well, it's one I added right at the end. It's called Two Lost Worlds. It's from 1951. This is one of my favorite, underrated, you've probably never heard of movies. It stars James Arness from Gunsmoke and Them and The Thing from Another World. But here he plays a pirate, like a rogue, dashing pirate, swashbuckler. And he, with his crew and, of course, a beauty, a damsel, they end up on an island of dinosaurs. So it's a pirate dinosaur movie. It's the only one I know of. It's dumb, but it's dumb fun. I would recommend.
You had me at pirate dinosaur movie.
Yeah, I should have led with that.
Cool. I mean, you know, it's sad. I've never even heard of that movie. I feel like I should have by now.
Well, like I said, it's a deep cut.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Awesome. Two Lost Worlds. That sounds great. The one that I want to shout out is In the Mouth of Madness from 1995. It's a John Carpenter movie. Some Carpenter fans, I think, would say it's maybe his last really good, really kind of like characteristic movie. I know that Vampires and Ghosts from Mars have some defenders, but In the Mouth of Madness, Sam Neill plays a writer, like a horror writer who very quickly goes crazy, kind of just like goes off the deep end. It's a little bit Lovecraftian. So that's a great movie. Highly recommended, In the Mouth of Madness, if you're a John Carpenter fan.
All right. And a Sam Neill fan.
Yeah, he's also in Event Horizon, which is like, he was in some good 90s horror movies / sci-fi movies. Of course, Jurassic Park being the most famous, but some others too.
And he's in The Omen 3, Damien's something or another. One more reason why I do want to go through that series. All right, this is a low-key Omen episode, turns out.
Yeah, I didn't even know he was in that. It comes full circle on Camp Kaiju. That's great. do want to mention a couple of upcoming releases as well. Zach Cregger's Companion. He made Barbarian a couple years ago. I'm pretty excited about that. Oz Perkins, who had kind of a hit with Long Legs last year. His movie The Monkeys coming out in about a month or so. And then Presence, by Steven Soderbergh, looks like a really unique ghost story. I think it's out in theaters now. I'm really excited to see that one.
Yeah, very interested in that. In February, we have on Camp Kaiju, we have Tusk 2014, horror film by Kevin Smith.
I'm very excited to talk about that. And then our episode after that will be Dracula's Daughter, which I'm very excited to talk about as well.
Indeed. Going back to some classic Universal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But tonight, again, we are talking about Invasion of Astro Monster, the sixth Godzilla film. Vincent, what is your personal history with this movie?
Oh, my goodness. Not a whole lot. Not like a deep history, but I got this on a DVD in a collection maybe 10 years ago, and it had been the first time I had seen it. And I instantly fell in love with the world of this movie, the science fiction, the going out into outer space. Rodan makes an appearance. I'm wishing Mothra was there, but that's okay. And I go back to this one of every once in a while. It's just like a warm blanket. You know, I came home from work last week and I just couldn't wait to stay up late and throw this movie on. I have quibbles, of course, that I'll get to, but that's my history.
I love that. I saw it for the first time for this episode recording. I just watched it a couple days ago. I watched the Japanese language version and then most of the English dub, not all of it, okay, though. So I came to this totally fresh. I was really excited about it because I love Ghidorah, the three-headed monster, which was the previous Godzilla movie. I don't think Invasion of Astro Monster lives up to those heights that I was expecting, but we'll talk more about that soon.
The War of the Gargantua. It began with a mysterious, wild storm at sea, and before the night was over, the whole world would hear of the terror of the Gargantuan. Where had such a monster come from? What forces created such a devastating destroyer? Who or what could stand up to it? Let him have it! Armies fought the monster with million-volt laser beams.
Another one!
You'll see all of their terrifying battle to the death when you come to the greatest monster movies ever made, The War of the Gantuas and Monster Zero.
A great Godzilla blazing a trail of terror to his Japanese homeland.
Captain, water in the conning tower.
Roaring defiance to the only enemy on Earth strong enough to challenge him, the unconquerable King Kong, giant gorilla god of this South Seas paradise, where sensuous maidens offer themselves in ritual sacrifice to his brute embrace.
Godzilla has a brain about this size. He is sheer brute force. While Kong is a thinking animal, his brain is considerably larger. About 10 times the size of this gorilla's skull. Being instinctive rivals, there is no doubt that they will attempt to destroy one another.
King Kong versus Godzilla, heading for their colossal collision.
In the ocean's unfathomable depths, a gigantic, man-like creature appears. Fiery depths of the earth comes a prehistoric mastodon of destruction. Never before has the screen known such heart-stopping terror. Starring Nick Adams.
Well, I feel he's very important from a scientific point of view.
I'd have to cut off a leg or an arm.
Doctors, I won't let you conduct this test.
Frankenstein. With the strength of 1,000 men. And every man's need for affection that makes him a willing captive.
The chain hurts you.
The new scoop of the century.
First, perhaps we'll dive into the cast and crew of the film. which is kind of fun because it's sort of like, you know, all the OGs kind of are like in Invasion of Astro Monster, like involved in some way. Starting with the director, Ishiro Honda, director of the original Godzilla, not to mention many of the ensuing kaiju films, Rodan, The Mysterians, Battle in Outer Space, Mothra, King Kong versus Godzilla, Mothra versus Godzilla, Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, so on and so forth. Really, you know, I mean, the producer who we'll talk about soon is kind of seen as one of the co-creators of Godzilla, but for my money, Ishiro Honda is kind of the creator of Godzilla. So he's back in the director's chair for this film.
The special effects are by Eiji Tsuburaya, creator of the special effects for, I think, all of those movies you just mentioned that were directed by Honda. And he would later go on and found Tsuburaya Productions and create Ultraman for television, and just another legend in the creation of special effects, the suitmation, the model work of the cities. And he's back doing some top-notch work here for Toho's film.
Totally. His assistant on this movie, Teruyoshi Nakano, was also assistant on many of the films that we mentioned above. He would become the lead special effects director on 1969's All Monsters Attack. Just wanted to shout him out here as well.
Yeah, that's important to know too, because as the Showa era continues, you'll realize that Astro Monster is kind of a high watermark in the original series, because the seventh film after this, new director, new composer, and I believe it is Nakano, Tsuburaya's assistant here, who ends up taking lead on the special effects. So yeah, he'll come back in future installments, but as we'll talk about, Astro Monster is sort of the last hurrah for a while.
Interesting. And I have some criticisms of the special effects even in this movie. So we'll talk about that soon.
All right. Shinichi Sekizawa, again, another fan favorite here. He had previously written Mothra versus Godzilla, Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, Mothra, King Kong, King Kong versus Godzilla, Battle in Outer Space. The list goes on. Sekizawa, it's so great, Matt, that like, now that we've talked about so many of these 60s Godzilla movies, I know Sekizawa's like filmography. I can just talk about him now. I know his style. He's known for a slightly more comedic bent, maybe not like laugh out loud funny, but there's a sense of humor, let's say, to his screenplays. So I like that. I like seeing these names pop up again. And now that I have some familiarity with them.
Yeah, I definitely know what you mean. I'm not quite at that point yet. You're definitely more knowledgeable about, like, you know, the Toho films in particular, and just kind of about kaiju films in general than I am. But I'm starting to recognize these names and like the aesthetics that they bring to the work that they do. It's very easy to see what you mean about Sekizawa kind of having a more comedic, maybe lighthearted approach to some of these screenplays. To be honest, it's not like my personal preference. I kind of gravitate towards like a darker, more like a menacing approach. But I do love Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, and there's some really fun stuff in this movie as well, of course.
Yeah, totally. I think that is a criticism that I think is fair. Like, man, this movie is so much fun, and it has some themes, some important themes. Because, you know, Honda, he wants to dig into these things. He wants to make 54 Godzilla all the time. Yeah. He has no sense of humor.
Well, pretty close, maybe, yeah.
No, I exaggerate. But my point is, had the screenwriter been willing to, like, dig into the stakes a little bit more of what's going on, I think you could have more movies on par with the 54 Godzilla or the first Rodan film. I think that's fair.
Yeah, totally. Yep.
Yeah.
Which again, we'll get into a little bit more pretty soon here, but just to kind of round out the crew here a little bit, Invasion of Astro Monster was mostly co-produced by two producers, Tomoyuki Tanaka of Toho Studios, one of the co-creators of Godzilla. He was around from the very start, from 1954's Godzilla. This movie, though, was also co-produced by United Productions of America, or UPA, which had a producer named Henry Saperstein, who was involved with this film from the very start. He also was involved with Frankenstein Conquers the World, I believe. Is that correct?
Right, right. Yeah. And War of the Gargantuas, a movie I'm dying to bring to the podcast. Yeah, Saperstein's really interesting. And Matt, I'm pulling all this information from that interview I sent you. Mm-hmm. And listeners, this is I'll share it in the show notes. But Godzilla Kaiju writer Steve Rifle interviews the daughters of Nick Adams and Henry Saperstein, Pat Saperstein and Allison Adams. And it's a 40-minute interview. Saperstein and Adams are reminiscing about their father's work with Toho in the 60s and shedding some really nice insight. So Saperstein, for instance, he was really instrumental in bringing these movies to the Western markets, to the United States, and selling them to the television studios. And he was really big into merchandising. And in a way, you can credit the exposure for Godzilla in the West largely to a lot of what he did as a businessman, just understanding that there's a market for these characters. And let's sell it, baby. Let's go. And I just think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that interview that you sent me is really fascinating. And, you know, my main takeaway, not to overgeneralize too much, but it seems like Saperstein and Adams, Nick Adams, both really, you know, they didn't look down on this work. They had a lot of fun doing it. They could see the appeal and the kind of like imagination, the excitement, the entertainment behind it. There was no, like, you know, of course there's a profit motive, as there always is in the industry, but they seemed to really love this work and enjoyed being a part of it.
Yeah, and later on I have some quotes out of a book by Steve Rifle and Ed Godzuski. Can't see it, Matt, but it's the Ishiro Honda biography I have. And they detail some of the production experiences Honda had with Nick Adams in particular. Mm. So a lot of positive stuff in here about those two.
Cool. I might have to borrow that book from you someday because I'm dying to read it.
Sounds absolutely great. Yeah, it's pretty great.
Cool. I'll just round out the crew here real quick and then we'll go into the cast. The cinematography for Invasion of Astro Monster is by Hajime Koizumi, and the music by the one and only, again, OG, Akira Ifukube.
Yeah.
One of my favorite composers of all time for movies.
Just outstanding.
Yeah. But let's dive into the cast of the film. You've talked about Nick Adams before. You mentioned earlier already in this recording that you're a big fan. Do you want to talk about him a little bit?
And how? I'll try to keep it brief, I guess. Nick Adams plays astronaut Glenn in this movie. Nick Adams had been a rising young movie star in the 1950s. He has a bit part in Rebel Without a Cause. He was nominated for an Oscar in 1963. And so he was big news. He was a star of a television show, Johnny Yuma. I personally have never seen it, but it was a big deal at the time. But by the mid-60s, his star was on the wane. And he was in his mid-30s by this point. And Saperstein worked out this production deal with Toho behind some kaiju films. Godzilla, Frankenstein Conquers the World, Astro Monster, and Gargantuas in particular. And Saperstein tapped movie stars who were on the decline to star in these movies. So Nick Adams does star in Astro Monster and Frankenstein Conquers the World. And he was really loved on set. Like, again, going back to that interview I sent you and what the authors detail in the Honda biography, Nick Adams was universally loved on the set. He brought a real go-get-em attitude. He was disciplined. He had an enthusiasm. And like you said, Matt, he didn't look down on these movies. And you could tell, I think his screen presence, he's having a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying he's James Dean up there, but you could tell he's having fun. And I think that translates to the audience having so much fun. So I appreciate that. I love that. And I want a quick shout out one more Nick Adams genre film called Die Monster Die. He starred in this movie. It was a British production with Boris Karloff. It's based on Lovecraft's Color Out of Space. So it's like a weird horror movie. If you can find this movie, I have, and it's worth it. And Nick Adams is being Nick Adams, but he's also with Boris Karloff. It's the best.
That sounds amazing. Is that like late 1960s?
Mid 65, okay. 66. That brings me to another personal note for Nick Adams. He did die tragically young, actually. In 1968, it was a pill overdose. I don't think it was ruled a suicide. Just kind of like a mysterious situation. Mm-hmm. But coincidentally, he died on February 7th, which, if you're listening to this episode when it drops on February 8th, it's the anniversary of his death. So, we'll pour one out for Nick Adams.
Totally. Rest in peace to, like, you know, one of the best, like, crossover presences in the Toho Godzilla franchise. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Global diplomacy a little bit, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, like, he's so funny because he's a New Yorker and he talks like that. And that's interesting because depending on what you watch, the sub or the dub version of this film, you either lose out on his accent or you really get to appreciate it. This was like the first time they had tried it. They wrote the screenplay in two languages, in Japanese and English, because Nick Adams did not speak Japanese and his co-stars mostly didn't speak English. So Honda had basically filmed the scene with Nick Adams saying his lines in English and the Japanese actors saying their lines in Japanese. So they didn't understand the words they were saying to each other, but a testament to their acting, they still knew how to act the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a process that they would then, that Toho would then go on to utilize in subsequent films.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, in the English dubbed version, Nick Adams' voice is actually on the soundtrack and all the other characters are, of course, overdubbed by other actors. And in the Japanese version, I think Nick Adams is the only one who is, you know, we don't hear his voice in the soundtrack, but the other actors we do.
Right.
And that's like, I think that was kind of a common practice, especially among like spaghetti westerns of like the 60s and 70s, where you would have like multinational casts where like one actor would be speaking Italian, another French, another German, another English, like maybe sometimes all in the same scene, which must have been, to your point, Vincent, like really difficult for the actors. But, you know, in a lot of cases, they make it work. And like, you know, in this particular case, testament to the cast to like play off of each other so well, which I think Nick Adams and Akira Takarada, who we'll talk about soon, they do play off of each other really well.
Yeah, they have. I think they have a lot of great chemistry that I think, again, really, really translates to the to your viewing pleasure of this film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's always, maybe this isn't the right time to talk about this, but I don't know, it's cool to hear if people prefer watching the Japanese subtitled version, like, you know, Japanese language English subtitled version or the English dubbed version. Like, I feel like both have their own pleasures. I like to hear the original Japanese dialogue, but at the same time, like, there's something charming about the English dubbed version, and you know, obviously you don't have to read the subtitles, maybe you can focus on the image a little bit more. So if you have the time, I feel like it's worth it to watch both versions, you know?
I agree. And I think I usually just go back and forth. I had watched the subtitled version so often. I was like, you know what? Let me watch the dubbed. I don't want to read tonight.
Yeah.
And then I had Nick Adams's voice in his Brooklynese dialect. And I was like, this is awesome. This is great. I will always watch this version.
Yeah, some of his dialogue delivery is awesome. And his like Brooklyn accent, which we'll probably talk about more. So yeah, I mean, you know, it's a good point that he died on February 7th. This is a great opportunity to commemorate Nick Adams, such a unique presence in kaiju film history.
Don't forget, I've got a surprise little game coming up for us.
Yes.
But you'll have to wait, listeners, till after the break.
Ooh, all right. I can't wait myself. See what happens. We'll talk briefly about the rest of the cast here as well. So Invasion of Astro Monsters stars Akira Takarada as Kazuo, another astronaut. Of course, Japanese character. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, why one is Japanese and one is American. But Takarada also was in a lot of kaiju films, Godzilla, Mothra versus Godzilla, so on and so forth. Kumi Mizuno plays Miss Namikawa, who is Nick Adams' love interest in the film. She was also in Frankenstein Conquers the World, Godzilla versus the Sea Monster. Of course, she co-starred with Adams in Frankenstein Conquers the World as well, so there's a little bit of overlap there. The film stars Keiko Sawai as Haruno, Kazuo's sister. She works for the World Space Agency in the film. I couldn't really find a lot of information about her, but I like her presence in this movie a lot. I think she's really great, very charismatic.
Yep. Yeah, she gives maybe a stereotype-busting role as, you know, a female in very male-dominated workplace culture in Japan at the time. She's willing to just to push back gently against her male supervisors.
Yeah. Yeah, because her brother is like very domineering and does not approve of her engagement to, this is a good time to bring this up. In the film, she is engaged to Tetsuo, played by Akira Kubo. Tetsuo is kind of like a mild-mannered inventor who has not really done very well for himself in life so far. So, Kazuo is kind of against their impending marriage, but you know, it's an interesting kind of like dynamic and tension among their characters. Maybe it's resolved a little bit too easily in the film, but for a while I do kind of like their conflict between those three characters.
Yeah, and I think Tetsuo, the character played by Akira Kubo, he is like the Sekizawa. He's the type of character Sekizawa likes to write. He's the comedic relief. He's like a little befuddled, bumbling, bespectacled. He wears glasses. that's me just giving up on the big words.
Yeah, he's kind of like the absent-minded professor a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Indeed. Akira Kubo plays that role very well. He also was in, or would go on to be in, Son of Godzilla, Destroy All Monsters, Space Amoeba, and Gamera, Guardian of the Universe from 1995, so the later version of that. But he's a good comedic presence here, for sure. Did you want to talk about any of the other cast members in the film?
I think the other big one just to touch on is Yoshio Tsuchiya. He's the leader of the Planet X, the Exilians, and he appeared in Kurosawa films like Seven Samurai and Redbeard. The actor himself had a fascination with UFOs. He even wrote some books on the subject, and he loved playing aliens in movies. Again, I think, like Nick Adams, like, just have fun with these movies.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to take everything so seriously. But then in having fun with it, you come off sincere and genuine. And I think you do end up giving a good performance.
Exactly. And I think that's why these movies, you know, stand well, to be determined, but stand the test of time and are so beloved by so many people, you know?
Yeah. Okay. One other thing about Tsuchiya. He actually recommended to Tsuburaya to include the Shie dance for Godzilla after he vanquishes Ghidra in their first fight. Some quick background on this. This happens to be a very infamous moment in the Godzilla franchise when Godzilla jumps up and down and does a little dance of victory. You think, why is that such a big deal? But this is what we're talking about. We're getting away from Honda's like serious foreboding vision, and we're making Godzilla more kid centric. He's dancing. He was talking in the previous movie. It's like, what's happening to Honda's vision? But it was a popular dance. It's called the Shie. It was very popular in the 1960s in Japan. It was a trademark of a manga character, Osumatsu-kun, and Tsuburaya had no reservations, and he put it in there. Apparently, Honda didn't even know about it. And I'll tell you again, referencing my Honda biography, according to Honda's son, he had never seen his father, quote, as pissed off as he was when the Shiei made it into this film.
When the Shiei hit the fan. That was a terrible pun. Sorry.
I feel like you had been saving that one. You delivered it so like, oh, this is my moment.
I didn't think about it until like 10 seconds ago, but the opportunity arose, you know? I couldn't say no. But it's kind of easy to imagine Honda being so pissed off about that. Like, you know, like you alluded to before, the original 1954 Godzilla is pretty serious. It has like very, you know, kind of dark, pessimistic themes. And like 11 years later, Godzilla's doing this funny little dance on Planet X. Like, I can understand how he would be a little bit dismayed about that.
Yeah. And at the, yeah, it'd be like, I don't know, Godzilla doing a, I was going to say a floss, but that's not even hip anymore. But like a floss move. You're like, what?
Yeah. Where did this come from? How would he even know? Yeah.
So that's kind of the equivalent.
Totally. And I think the actor in the Godzilla suit, Haruo Nakajima, also did not like the idea. He didn't want to do it, but he was directed to do so. So he did.
There you go.
Controversial moment, to your point, in Godzilla film history. Another story I think is kind of funny about Yoshio Tsuchiya. He was in Seven Samurai, like you said before, Vincent, but he wanted to be in Godzilla instead. And he was kind of like, when they were shooting on the same studios, like Toho Studios. So like the actor would go to the Godzilla set instead of the Seven Samurai set. Cause he was like, he wanted to be in that movie. And he was like, you know, I'm in this Kurosawa movie, but I got to be in the next Godzilla film. Like, that's what I really want to do, which I mean, Seven Samurai is an all time classic. Of course, Godzilla is as well, but I just think that's a funny story.
That's so, yeah, I love it. He should be on our podcast talking about UFOs.
If only. I'm fairly sure he's not alive anymore, but if, you know, if his spirit can join us someday, well, we should make that happen.
If you hear us, please join us.
Yeah. The spirit of Peter Lorre will communicate with you to make this happen.
Ooh. All right, Peter, get on it.
All right, let's dive into the production backstory of Invasion of Astro Monster a little bit. So this was the sixth film in the Godzilla franchise, right after Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster. Japanese-American co-production between Toho Studios and UPA, or United Productions of America. So in the 1960s, producer Henry Saperstein of UPA was asked to acquire monster movies to distribute in North America. Vincent, you were talking about this a little bit before.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the first film that Saperstein was heavily involved with from the very beginning. I think he had a little bit to do with the, was it Frankenstein Conquers the World?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this was the first one where he was involved from the start. UPA provided 50% of the funding for the film. And Saperstein encouraged screenwriter Sekizawa to, you know, try to get into the action a little bit more quickly. He didn't want to have all these kind of like government press conferences when like a kind of long prologue before we get to the monsters. I have my own complaints about that, but I'll save that for later in the episode.
And
it was also Saperstein's idea to incorporate the alien invasion theme, which some Toho Studios sci-fi films had done in the past, but not really so much in the Godzilla films. It's a little bit in Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, but maybe not so much.
Yeah, it's part of the legacy a little bit. This is the first Godzilla movie to incorporate those themes. Not well, there was aliens in Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, but in Astro Monster, the kaiju themselves are brainwashed, they're mind controlled to destroy the Earth, which is something we will see in future installments.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of Invasion of Astro Monster is set in outer space, which I don't think Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, maybe extremely briefly, but not very much.
I don't think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. So that's a new direction for the franchise, for better or worse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Saperstein also wanted to cast an American actor, like we said before. Nick Adams was just the right level of famous and affordability for Saperstein.
And it worked out perfectly.
he you know, in some ways, he is as famous now as he ever was because he said, yes, let's go make some monster movies.
Yeah. And we love him for it.
Yeah.
So another thing that kind of like exhibits the participation of an American company is the design of the P-1 rocket and the astronaut suits in the film, which were based on NASA's Project Gemini missions. So it's fairly easy to see that, you know, this very much is a Japanese-American co-production to a greater extent than any of the Godzilla movies that had come before.
And I think that's in line with the burgeoning popularity of these kind of space adventures in the 60s, particularly, both in Japan and in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And kind of going along with the kind of friendlier, more comedic, lighthearted tone that we've already talked about, we also have a new Godzilla suit in the film. The Godzilla suit was made by Taizo Toshimitsu. It has larger eyes and less pronounced dorsal fins, which lead to a friendlier look. I can't remember the next time after this that the Godzilla suit would be redesigned, but I think it would kind of go more in this direction, at least for a while, that we see sort of like a friendlier, more cartoonish version of Godzilla.
Yeah, rounder features, softer features.
Yeah.
Yeah. The budget was less this time around, so the special effects were a little shoddier, and the model work was the same. And there is some recycled footage in this movie from previous films, Rodan, Mothra, and Ghidorah, the three-headed monster. This was also the first for the Godzilla franchise, the use of stock footage for better or worse, as we'll say.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a quote you included here, Matt. Honda regretted these budget cuts, and quote said, "It's no wonder we could not make anything good around that period. It's a sad story," because he knew, he said, that audiences would notice this footage. And I don't know. It sounds like Honda had mixed feelings about this production.
Certainly. And I wish I could remember offhand, but did Honda direct the next couple movies in the series? I don't think he did he? Or he directed the next one?
No, he did not.
Oh, okay. Oh, you mentioned that before. I'm sorry.
He did not direct the next two. He would come back for All Monsters Attack and Godzilla's Revenge, and then he'd go away for a few movies, and then he wouldn't come back till Terror of Mechagodzilla.
Wow, I'm very impressed, first of all, that you know that just off the top of your head. That's awesome. But it also kind of makes sense, if he was like not feeling great about the series, that he would take some time away after this film.
Yeah. You know, Matt, maybe not everyone know this, but I got my movie titles mixed up just then, so I'm not 100% perfect. Godzilla's Revenge is the same as All Monsters Attack.
Mm.
I meant to say Destroy All Monsters and All Monsters Attack.
That was just a test to see if any of the listeners picked up on that.
Yes. I plead forgiveness, listeners.
I'm still impressed, personally. and you know, like, when Honda says it's no wonder we could not make anything good around that period, I love Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster. That's my second favorite Godzilla movie after the first one. So
yeah.
I personally would disagree with that statement, but he's closer to it, of course. So he, you know, has his own perspective.
Yeah, I agree. I love that movie, too.
Yeah. In any case, Invasion of Astro Monster came out in Japan on December 19th, 1965, to mixed reviews. I think some critics maybe did not like the direction that the franchise was going in, sort of like we've already talked about. Mm. This was the 10th highest grossing Japanese film of the year, which doesn't seem terrible, but is not quite at the same heights as previous Godzilla movies.
And you know, this would be the last Showa era film to crack the top 10.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah. When you get into the movies after this, which we haven't really on Camp Kaiju, but the overarching theme is where the studio is hemorrhaging money. We can't compete with TV. Cut budgets. And that's why Godzilla just kind of becomes more Saturday matinee type of entertainment.
Yeah. Like I think of the few, you know, Godzilla movies from this era, but a little bit later that we've talked about on the podcast, like Son of Godzilla and Terror of Mechagodzilla. Yeah. Neither of which are my favorites. And it's easy to see that. And like some mm-hmm. of the later, I think it's the Heisei era, right? That starts in 1984.
Yeah.
From what I've seen, those movies generally are pretty awesome. I love what I've seen from that era. But there does kind of seem to be this stretch of like the 60s and 70s, late 60s and 70s, where personally not my favorites, but you know.
Totally. And there's some weird gems in there too, I got to tell you. Future Camp Kaiju episodes, 100%.
Which I cannot wait to discover.
They get, sure. Yeah, the direct, yeah, it gets weird.
Weird is good, I think. The American version of Invasion of Astro Monster, which was called Monster Zero, was not released in the United States until July 1970 by Marin Films on a double bill with War of the Gargantuas. It grossed $3 million on its initial run in the United States. So that's a period of 5 years in between the Japanese and the American release. Mm. From the research that I did, admittedly not extremely extensive research, there are kind of like conflicting accounts for that. Some people say that, Saperstein said that there was a lot of like re-recording that had to be done, a lot of like re-edits, sound design, things like that, that accounted for that 5 year delay. There were some other reports saying that UPA just didn't have a lot of faith in monster movies or in this one in particular and kind of shelved it for 5 years. So I don't know if there's a definitive reason for that delay, but in any case, 5 years later, it came out in the United States.
Yeah. Interesting.
This might be a good time for a sponsor break.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Smooth segue. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Link in the show notes. Vincent, do we have any messages from Mina's mailbox?
Yeah, we've got a fun one today, everybody. Bit of a story here. So this comes from a former student of mine. His name is Monty. And Monty keeps in touch with a coworker of mine. And he texted her. And then she showed me this text from Monty. Monty, if you're listening, text me back. He says, could you tell Hanum, a.k.a. Ham Ham, that the Godzilla Minus One episode of his podcast was goated and the Godzilla samples were great additions? Thanks.
Indeed they are, yeah.
Thank you, Monty. I love anytime someone calls our podcast goated. I'm presuming that's like the goat.
Yeah. Greatest of all time. Yeah, that's awesome.
100%.
That's awesome. Thank you, Monty. That's good to hear.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, bud, and hope you're well. Matt, is that someone by the door looking in your window? Is it like a little squat German-looking fella with
oh my God.
A bowl cut?
I think it might be. I think so.
Oh, He's in the room behind you. Hello, Matthew.
Oh my God, Peter.
Hi. I just don't mind me. I gotta get to the bucket of fish heads in the refrigerator.
We forgot to feed you. I'm so sorry, man.
That's okay. Now I can leave the podcasting booth so I can just help myself come and go. Maybe in the middle of the night when you're fast asleep. I'll try not to disturb you, but just know that I'll be creeping around.
Well, I'm probably not going to sleep at all tonight if I think about you creeping around my bedroom in the middle of the night, but, you know, it's cool. You're welcome. You can come in.
Well, believe me, Matthew, I am not as scary as some of these Poverty Row picture show movies that I'll be talking about tonight or today, this week. I'll be talking about The Ape from Monogram, a truly fiendish film starring Boris Karloff from 1940. But I got to get back to my booth now and get ready to record, and I got to munch on these fish heads.
Well, I can't wait to hear it, Peter. Good luck. It's going to be amazing as always.
Okay, goodbye.
I was Skitsiknik. Goodbye.
You got to meet him. There he was.
Yeah.
In your room.
He kind of startled me a little bit, but you know, it happens.
So I didn't know. You gave him a key or like what?
I didn't. No, so I'm a little unsettled right now. I don't know how he got into my apartment, but you know, it's cool. I guess he's a welcome guest from now on.
All right, that's it. You're living with Peter Lorre.
Yeah. It's going to be the name of my autobiography, Living with Peter Lorre.
That's good. Okay. Well, you know, we got some more fun coming up, everybody. After Peter Lorre talks with the Poverty Row Picture Show, we're going to come up to my fun little game here.
Welcome to Poverty Row Studios on the other side of Hollywood, where the stars were dimmer and the red carpets dripped with blood. Together, we will watch the best of the worst. Movies known for their limited budgets, outlandish concepts, and questionable performances. But with enough haunted houses, zombies, ape men, and devil bats to keep you up at night. This is the Poverty Row Picture Show. And I dare you to sleep through these nightmares. Oh, listeners, oh my goodness, if you've ever tasted Matthew's fish heads, you'd know what a delicacy I have here. Oh, he is really a swell guy for taking me in the way he has. I tell you, I have come a long way since the imprisonment I suffered last season. I tell you, these fish heads. All right, enough monkey business. Let's get to The Ape, starring Boris Karloff. This film from Monogram Pictures stars the legend in his only Poverty Row outing. Karloff had just starred in the previous year's Son of Frankenstein with Universal, and his star was bigger than ever. In The Ape, Karloff plays a seemingly innocent doctor who is searching for a cure for polio. However, a gorilla has recently escaped the circus and begins murdering the townsfolk. Karloff's doctor then uses the spinal fluid from these victims to complete the life-saving medicine. Karloff and the gorilla are truly a dastardly duo until the finale shocking twist. It will put you over a barrel of monkeys. It is so bananas. Now, The Ape is no King Kong, but it does offer plenty of campiness to make it worth your while. And Karloff rises above the material with a subdued yet sincere performance. He leaves all the absurdity to The Ape, here played by Ray Corrigan, an actor we will see again play the part of a fiendish killer gorilla, an entire genre popular with the Poverty Row Studios. The screenplay for The Ape was co-written by screenwriter Kurt Siodmak, who was just getting started in Hollywood. But after The Ape, he would make a name for himself writing The Wolfman, I Walked with a Zombie, Donovan's Brain, and other classics. Well, as for The Ape, I guess we all have to start somewhere. Next time on the Poverty Row Picture Show, we now turn our attention to the skies, cover our necks from the impending attack of the Devil Bat, a Bela Lugosi movie from PRC that makes The Ape look like a nominee for Best Picture. Yes, listeners, keep hanging in there and you will witness some truly batty filmmaking when a rat with wings is turned into a rampaging hellspawn of Satan. Speaking of, where has my own little vermin friend run off to? Oh no, dear listeners, I do not like it when Pierre hides from me. He cannot be trusted. No, do not let your guard down. Not since the incident last season with the meat cleaver.
and horror. Die, monster, die. Starring Boris Karloff, Nick Adams, Susan Farmer, and Planet of the Vampires. Starring Barry Sullivan, space explorers fighting planet vampires. Boris Karloff as the lust-mad stone monster. Two nerve-jolting terror thrillers. Die, monster, die.
Matt, Glenn, played by Nick Adams, has one of the best movie monologues I have ever heard on the silver screen. I would like to challenge you to a game of dueling Glens. And we'll each read this monologue, doing our best Nick Adams as Glenn. And listeners, you get to vote on who did it best.
And if, I love this.
If you participate, you get entered into the drawing for a free Nick Adams fan club t-shirt. Patrons, you're already in, but please still vote. Let's see who's got the chops.
Oh, man. I can already tell you're going to win, but I'm so excited. This is going to be fun.
Well, I don't know. I got to, you know, I have a sleeping baby next door, so I got to keep it down a bit.
You just got to commit. You have to fully commit to the performance.
I can go first.
Okay.
Give me Namikawa's line right before, though. Lead me in a little bit.
Okay. Should I also explain? This is from Miss Namikawa, who is Glenn's kind of pseudo-fiance, his love interest in the movie.
Who turns out to be a robot.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Or robot.
Yeah.
Okay. Whenever you're ready.
All right. You have to become a citizen of our planet X so we can marry. That's the only way we can save you.
Look, Namikawa, we're not robots. What kind of peace would it be if we were controlled by machines? In defense of Earth, we're going to fight to the last man, baby. Now where's your conscience, or have you turned that over to your computers too, huh? Hey, listen to me, Namikawa. If there's any chance of averting this war, you better tell me about it, and tell me about it right now, because if we don't find a solution to this thing, happiness in this world ain't going to be worth a hill of beans. You hear?
Amazing. I love it. It's an amazing scene. It's a classic. And you do it justice. Well done.
Well, the floor is yours.
All right. Can I have the Namikawa lead-in line as well?
Yep. Okay.
Thank you.
You have to become a citizen of our planet X so we can marry. That's the only way we can save you.
Look, Namikawa, we're not robots. What kind of peace would it be if we were controlled by machines? In defense of Earth, we're going to fight to the last man, baby. Now where's your conscience, or have you turned that over to your computers too, huh? Hey, listen to me, Namikawa. If there's any chance of averting this war, you better tell me about it, and tell me about it right now. Because if we don't find a solution to this thing, happiness in this world ain't going to be worth a hill of beans. You hear?
Bravo. Bravo. That, you gave it the oomph.
Next time. I don't have a sleeping baby next door, so we're in the next room.
It's an excuse.
I think yours is closer to Nick Adams, so you know I kind of maybe put my own spin on it, for better or worse, you know.
Yeah, better or for worse. Well, that's our tribute to Nick Adams on this weekend, on this episode. So, listeners, write in campkaiju@gmail.com, vote Matt, Vincent, and we'll see who comes out on top.
Nick Adams comes out on top. That's what I
always
say.
I love that line. If we don't find a solution to this thing, happiness in this world ain't going to be worth a hill of beans.
I love the expression, a hill of beans. That should be brought back, I think.
Yeah, it's very like Humphrey Bogart, Casablanca.
Yeah. And he says baby kind of a lot in this movie. And like not just to Namikawa, but to other characters too, which I always find pretty amusing.
It's rather campy.
Yeah. Perhaps it will come back later in this episode. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. Well, that might be the best. I mean, like you said, not just the best monologue in this movie, but one of the best in cinematic history. So there you go.
No joke, though. I will say, all kidding aside, when he broke into that monologue, I could believe he was nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
Because it was very in line with other, let's say, like actor studio type of performances. Think Brando in Waterfront, Dean in Rebel Without a Cause. It had that energy to it that I like. It really sizzled.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like you said earlier in the episode, he's no James Dean, but he certainly is like a part of that community of actors, and you can see the influence there. And like, you have to admire the dedication and the personality that he brings to it. Well, let's talk about the themes in Invasion of Astro Monster a little bit. I would say maybe at first glance, this seems like a fun kind of like, you know, battle in outer space sort of movie that doesn't have a lot of themes, but there might be some. Are there any that you want to mention right off the bat?
I think Honda is displaying his true belief in internationalism. I think Honda, you see this in the Mothra movies, in Ghidra, the three-headed monster. Like, we're dealing with the United Nations. We're dealing with the United World Space Agency. There's like great international cooperation that watching this movie now, you know, post Trump's second presidency, in this really increasing time of isolationism, I found a movie like this weirdly hopeful, or at least inspirational, sadly, but I found it inspirational.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's, you know, on the one hand, there's this theme that maybe global diplomacy is difficult and you can never be entirely sure if like an alliance is going to work out. Like, the whole plot of the movie is that, you know, these astronauts go to Planet X and they think that Planet X is going to help them. Or, well, you know, give them the cure for cancer. They're going to give them the data to cure cancer on Earth in exchange for bringing Godzilla and Rodan up to Planet X so they can defeat King Ghidorah. So, you know, that's the allegiance that's laid out before them. Planet Earth goes along with it, and it backfires spectacularly. I won't try to give any plot spoilers here, but, you know, it's like, I feel like the plot of the movie is basically like, you trust another, like, global, or in this case interplanetary, community, but, you know, are they gonna like come around and like bite you in the ass? You never know. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, like, to your point, it's kind of like inspiring and hopeful, but also like, man, it's kind of like, can we all get along, but in like sort of like a global diplomacy sort of atmosphere, you know?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I don't know, what if all the countries had said, nah, do your own thing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, the hopeful part of it is that Glenn and Kazuo do work together, and it's never really explained. I mean, I guess they're probably both parts of the World Space Agency, and that's why the American and the Japanese astronaut are going up together, but it's never really explained in the film. And honestly, I kind of wanted a little bit more of that. Like, the 60s were the time of the space race, and I thought it would have been kind of interesting to have this theme of like competition to see who can get up there first. But yeah, to your point, I mean, that's a hopeful part of the plot that, like, you know, these two countries are working together to save Earth, basically.
Yeah, right. But interesting to see maybe additional countries thrown into the mix. I don't know. It would have been too much of to ask, like, you have a Soviet astronaut there, like for American markets. But, you know,
yeah, true.
Maybe there's a braver version of this movie where you include a Russian.
Yeah, I think it would have been more timely and maybe a little bit more interesting in terms of what was actually going on in reality in 1965. But yeah, it still conveys the theme of, you know, diplomacy, working together, if that's even feasible in like the modern age or whatever. Trump would say no, but this movie would say yes.
And honestly, which one am I going to watch, you know, 7 days a week, twice on Sunday?
I sure hope it's Invasion of Astro Monster, but I don't know the answer to that question.
It's Invasion of Astro Monster.
Yeah, right? I'm just kidding. Yeah. I know you well enough by now. I also know you might cut all of that out of the episode, and that's okay.
I don't think so. I'm all for it. We're going to leave it hanging out there, folks.
Nice. I love it. yeah, but that's the interesting theme of the movie, I would say, for sure. Or the most prominent one, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe there's like a touch of critique of capitalism, because like Tetsuo is this inventor who has this kind of ridiculous invention called the Lady Guard that seems like kind of like a, you know, rape whistle. I hate to use that term. It's like an alert if like a woman is under attack or whatever, you know? Yeah. And then it seems like that invention is going to be like bought by this major corporation, and then he's kind of betrayed. Of course, that corporation is actually like a front for the ex-aliens. So that theme is like muddied a little bit. But I do feel like in 1960s Japan, that portrayal of a corporation that's not totally to be trusted is just kind of relevant and like a sign of where Japanese society was at the time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One other thing I thought about almost in hindsight was the relationship between Glenn and Namikawa. You know, at first she's just playing this sort of basic femme fatale type character. But then their final scene together, and I think it's a testament to the actors' chemistry, but I believe their stakes and their passion for each other. And she's like, I'm a robot, but we can still be together. And as we just did our monologues, he's like, no, baby, we can't. And I found it to be a more grandiose version of the relationship we see in Terror of Mechagodzilla between the protagonist and his android girlfriend. And I don't know, I just think there's really something interesting thematically and science fiction-y in that kind of star-crossed lover, the human and the android. Can they truly love each other? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's it is pretty moving in this movie, and I won't say what happens to the Namikawa character, but it's very poignant, and you feel like maybe they could have made it work if things had gone differently, you know?
Yeah. I'm thinking of that great line from Terror of Mechagodzilla. Cat, I forget her name, but he's like, even though you're an android, I still love you.
That's great screenwriting.
Oh man, if only I could tap into that.
But no, you're right. That is a theme of the movie. And like, you know, I think it's a little bit too about like computerized thinking and like algorithms and like predicting human behavior, because like that's what the ex-aliens do. They have this like computer on their spaceship that predicts everything that's going to happen and like lays out a plot to like, you know, prepare for the best course of action. And of course in the film nothing goes as expected, and I feel like in addition to this theme of, you know, can humans and androids coexist or even fall in love, there's also this theme of like, what is this kind of like computerized, rigid, logical, algorithmic way of thinking? Mm-hmm. And like, how does that differ from like human behavior? Which again is, you know, in an age of AI is kind of more relevant than ever.
Yeah, I actually picked up on that too, because I have been thinking so much more about technology in our lives. And this is really interesting segue, or just this quick sidebar. I'm noticing, Matt, as we talk about like upcoming movies today, and some recent movies, I feel like there is a trend of sort of dystopian technology in horror right now.
Mm.
And I think that is just part of our cultural fears subconsciously, that we are in a new frontier right now of AI, of robotics, of surveillance. And I thought about all that while watching this movie, as silly as it is, but it is that dichotomy between machines and what it means to be a human being.
Absolutely. Yeah. I thought about that too in this film. And I think especially the scenes set on the ex-alien's ship, which has that like computerized operating system. I definitely thought about it during those scenes for sure.
Yeah.
So maybe more than meets the eye in this film. Maybe not.
As long as you're wearing your like wraparound black visors. Like
yeah. Aliens. It's a good look for sure. Yeah. should we talk about the form and aesthetic, or should we dive into our individual breakdowns?
I think we should dive into our breakdowns.
Well, maybe I'll start off with the good and then I'll turn it over to you and we can kind of go back and forth if that works for you.
Sounds great.
So my favorite thing about this movie is just the production design, broadly speaking, like the cinematography, the sets, especially like the outer space backdrops, the costume design. Mm. All of it is really fun. It's like exactly what you want with like a 1960s retro sci-fi vibe. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily convincing, but I think it's more fun and more stylish because of that. And kind of like I just alluded to, I think the scenes set on Planet X and on the X aliens, I call it a ship before, but like I was actually referring to their like subterranean lair on their planet. All of that looks amazing. It's so fun. It's so stylish. That's the best part of the movie, in my opinion.
I think stylish is the word. And most of my positive notes are about that production design. I think it does indeed get into that 60s science fiction vibe, very Star Trek. And there's a starry night canvas backdrop in which you see the spaceship flying in the foreground. And there's, I'll use your word, stylish shot where that spaceship and the starry night backdrop seamlessly transitions into the backdrop of the restaurant.
Yeah.
I was like, that's just what I watch these movies for. And it's like really kind of magical in the surrealist kind of way. I wish the movie maybe had more of that, but I appreciated it nonetheless.
I love that edit as well. That's a great moment. It's kind of tongue in cheek a little bit. I feel like it's almost like making fun of like the, you know, low budget like outer space backdrops. Yeah. But it works really well.
Right. Like it's not a high budget backdrop, but it's used creatively.
Yeah. Right after that, or shortly thereafter, there's another great cut where like there's a line of dialogue where somebody's like, oh, this is gonna like flip him on his head when he hears about this. And then the next shot is that character actually upside down on the screen because like he's in the spaceship cockpit and like, you know, that's like it's zero gravity or whatever. So I just thought that was a really clever edit to go from like that line of dialogue to like literally he's flipped on his head. That's great.
I laughed out loud because it was so dumb.
Yeah. Dumb but clever at the same time.
Yeah. It's just like, oh, okay. That's where we're going with this movie.
Right.
All right. I'm buckled in. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, I love stuff like that. And
yeah,
I don't know. I think that's why I like Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster so much, which I feel is like that vibe 100% of the time. And this movie isn't like that the whole way through, but still some really great moments like that for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you want to start us off with what you thought was bad about the movie?
Yeah. I also just want to say that I I've said this ad nauseum, but the acting in this movie, I think is really good. I think their chemistry is really good. Good. Takarada and Adams really sell this movie for me. And I believe them to be buddies. For the bad.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off with the good stuff. You can mention more good stuff.
No, that's it. Yeah. For the bad, and I hate to even, I think bad is a strong word for me here, but like there's some general lack of monster action, which I don't mind because I still think this movie is well done regardless. It's just like an alien invasion science fiction movie. But there was a point where I thought, I'm not seeing as much of the kaiju as I would like to. So maybe not the monster mash some people might expect. What would you think? I feel like you've got a little bit more to share.
Well, I totally like 1000% agree about the lack of monster action. And I think it's so disappointing that the first times we see Godzilla and Rodan, like they don't do anything. They're just like trapped in electromagnetic beams and they're sucked up into space. Like, it should always be an awesome moment when we first see those monsters. And this time it's just like, oh, they're just frozen in one place and they're being sucked up into the sky. So that was disappointing. I do love King Ghidorah. I should have added that to my good part, but like, that monster is my favorite kaiju that I've ever seen in a monster movie, probably, unless you count like, you know, Frankenstein and stuff like that. But I love all the Ghidorah stuff in this movie. But yeah, Godzilla and Rodan don't really have very much to do. There's like that one fight on Planet X, and there's a little bit on Earth, but really not very much. Even aside from that, though, this movie spends a lot of time on the human dramas, and like those are almost never the interesting part of a kaiju film, and that's true in this case. Like, I know I mentioned before that like the conflict between Tetsuo Kazuo and, is it Hano? I forget her name, sorry. But the two people that are engaged and then her brother, you know, that is moderately interesting, but like the stuff with his invention makes no sense. Like he just happened to make an invention that's like the exact pitch and frequency that's going to like affect these aliens. And that's what leads to the climax of the movie. And I know I've talked a lot about on Camp Kaiju before about like not looking for realism and logic in these movies. And I still think that's true, but there needs to be some internal logic to like hold the story together. Mm. And for me in this movie, that just does not exist. So yeah, like narratively, I don't think it works all that well. And the monster stuff is really disappointing, I would say.
I agree with you that I think that B plot is muddled. It's unclear. At one point, I was even watching it with the dubbed version, and I was like, wait. Tetsuo is being kidnapped now. Who are these people? I didn't track all of that B plot with his character.
Yeah. I'm sure we both have campy stuff that we want to talk about. I'll go first. I feel like maybe you have more than I do in the campy categories.
Okay.
but mine is also going to be Nick Adams focused. My favorite line of dialogue that he gives in the Japanese version, but also, you know, in the English dubbed version, in the Japanese one, it's not really him, but in the English dubbed version, when they find out that the ex-aliens are betraying them, Nick Adams is like, "Those double-crossing finks," which just like seems like it should be from like a 1930s film noir, like 1940s film noir, you know, and like his like ridiculous Brooklyn accent in the middle of this group of Japanese scientists. I just really laughed out loud at that moment. In general, I would say that his line delivery is like some of the campiest and most fun stuff in this movie. And that was my favorite example.
I have one line, Nick Adams exchange with the leader of the Exilians, and this was so funny. The leader says to Glenn, and I forget Takarada's character's name, but he's saying to Glenn, you know, the American, there are going to be women involved, good looking women. And Glenn like drops it in and is really impassioned. He said, you know, there's the heart too. And there's more than just the surface stuff with women. And he's cut off, and the leader of the Exilians, I'm paraphrasing, but says, all right, let's not get into it right now.
Yeah. That moment is great. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. It appears that all the ex-aliens, except for the robots who all look alike, are men. So I guess that line of dialogue kind of makes sense, you know?
Yeah, it was really funny and like perfect comedic timing. I also, next time you watch this movie, I want you to count every time Nick Adams hitches up his pants. He does it almost every time he starts a line. He unbuttons his jacket and just like does a little hitch and puts his hands on his hips to deliver a line.
I feel like I noticed that a couple times, but maybe not as frequently as you did. That's awesome.
Every time. And once you notice it, you can't unsee it.
Could be a good drinking game.
Yeah, it could be.
Every time he hitches his pants or says baby, you have to take a shot.
Ooh.
You will be passed out with like 20 minutes in, you know?
Yeah. Boy.
I mean, Nick Adams is great, but like all the campy stuff in this movie is basically him for the most part.
Yeah, 100%, but it's so charming.
Yeah. I guess I would just add two in the campy category. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Do you have
Okay. I'm done.
You know, we mentioned like it's pretty low budget and like some of the model and effects work is pretty chintzy and shoddy. It's kind of funny watching this so shortly after The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, which came out 10 years before, 11, maybe 12? 13, actually. Yeah, somewhere around there. But, you know, the special effects in that movie are pretty great. I mean, they hold up. And the special effects in Invasion of Astro Monster, not so much. Like, you know, you can see like little kind of like army soldiers just like sitting in one spot in a truck, like in a model truck, you know.
Yeah.
The like rear projection work is never really like very convincing. You can tell it's like the actors are like not even close to like the background footage. And I, you know, some of it is fun. Some of it is like, oh God, that looks so bad, you know? So I would put that in the campy category as well in this case.
Yeah. 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 When you see just like toys being used to substitute actors.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And yeah. Like very blatant wires, you know, like for.
Yeah, there were a lot of visible wires, which I try to be forgiving.
Right.
Maybe it's my high def TV. I don't know. But I want to forget that the wires are there.
Exactly. Yeah. Like it's I simultaneously love and hate that effect a little bit where it's like, oh, this is like charming and like hands on, but also a little bit hard to believe. And
yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, good and bad, you know?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think it might be time to give Invasion of Astro Monster our rating. As always on Camp Kaiju, we have our four ratings. Number one, it's a timeless classic. It definitely stands the test of time. Number two, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great. It stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest rating, it is not worth revisiting. It definitely does not stand the test of time.
Mm.
Vincent? Well, yeah.
Yeah, I'll leave you the final word.
Okay.
I think this movie is a classic, or the second, I don't even remember my own ratings, the second to highest. I think it stands the test of time. I think it's depiction of space and Planet X is just really beautiful to watch with the stars and the moons and the creature fights on the planet are really, really fun. I think the costume design for the Exilians is so iconic and memorable. I love the general vibes of this movie. But Matt, you actually kept me from giving it the highest rating when you, I think, rightly critiqued the entrance of Godzilla and Rodan. I think you're absolutely right. The first time we see giant monsters, it should be awe-inspiring. And here, I do think now that they are treated almost for granted. It's just like, oh, it's Godzilla and Rodan. And I'm like, no. It doesn't matter if you've seen them 6 times or 100 times. They must always be treated like the giant gods that they are. So that's what's going to keep it from the top tier for me.
Nice. Yeah, I feel very similarly. I think I'm going to have to give it one rank lower than what you gave it.
Ooh.
I think this movie is fun, but it does not stand the test of time for me. Part of it, like you said, is the lack of monster action. I think like it's you know, they wasted some great opportunities for like awesome action scenes where the ex-aliens try to like bring these monsters up to outer space. Like those could have been amazing scenes, and we don't see that in this movie. I think maybe more unfortunate is that we spend a lot of time with the human characters, and like generally that's not very interesting. I would have loved to see a little bit more like exploration of like the global diplomacy theme in the context of the space race. You know, as it is in this movie, it's charming that astronaut Glenn, which is a great name, and Kazuo like go up to Planet X together. It's very like inspiring and charming, but like there's the potential for more kind of like real world subtext there, you know, and I would have loved to see that in the movie. So I think a lot of wasted opportunities, especially in comparison with Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, which I love so much. But yeah, I mean, it looks great. It is fun a lot of the time, so I can't give it the lowest rating. It's a very entertaining movie for sure.
Yeah, I think that's all fair. But thank you for bringing this movie.
Yeah, it was fun to bring it to the podcast. And like, you know, whenever we can talk about like one of the original, you know, one of the Godzilla films from like the original era, it's very satisfying for sure.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
All right. Well, next time on Camp Kaiju, we're going to talk about Tusk. Until then, thank you so much for hanging out, friends. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can also share this podcast with a friend, subscribe to the website, and send us listener comments at campkaiju@gmail.com or on Instagram. The links are in the bio or the show notes. Links are in the show notes.
Hey.
sorry. If you would like to be a featured voice on the show, leave us a voicemail at 612-470-2612 telling us about your favorite monster movies and memories. Please check out our website, campkaijupodcast.com, for more information. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with Minya's Mailbox music by Ben Cook Feltz. Thanks again, friends, and until next time, stay campy. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the show notes.
Hey, one more thing. How come all the women here look alike?
I should think that you, Glenn, would agree that our girls are attractive.
Yeah, but beauty is more than skin deep. Beauty is also what's in the heart.
Let's not argue the matter.